You'd made the three short films, Childhood, Child and Maiden, and Death and Transfiguration. Let's talk about the graduation to making a feature. Did it feel like a real challenge, or did it feel like a natural progression for you? Because that will lead into my second question about the structure of the film. But if we can just talk about how the opportunity to make Distant Voices, Still Lives came along.
Well, the trilogy was so depressing. It was shown in America, and they said, these films making Mark Bergman look like Jerry Lewis. So I'd gone over to New York with the trilogy, and the BFI had funded me then. I thought, isn't this wonderful, you know, walking through Central Park. And then the film was shown twice, and the first night I had a queue, my first queue, and the second night my first demonstration. This Organization for the Protection of American Virgins or something said that they hated it. So anyway, I came back thinking, oh, well, you know, it was a lovely, lovely trip, but I had to finish drama school because I was at drama school at the time. And I went into Peter Sainsbury and just said, I just went in to say thank you for sending me there. And he said, well, we want to commission you to do something. And I thought, oh, blimey. I said, yeah, well, yeah, I will, I'll think. And I wrote the first part of this, Distant Voices, Still Lives. And he gave us the money to shoot it. And when it was finished, by this time Peter had left, and it was Colin McCabe who'd taken over and said, we would like to put it out now. I said, please, will you not do so? There's another part to it. I know there is. And he said, okay. And there was a gap of 2 years. Okay. You wouldn't be able to do that now. I mean, you just would not be able to do it now. And it only cost $750,000, which is a lot of money even then, but you couldn't make it for that now. You just couldn't. I was surprised that I was asked. Obviously, I was enormously flattered. But after my father died, when I was about seven, my family used to talk all the time. It was like kind of therapy, I think. This is 52. And I listened to all these stories. My first 7 years, obviously he was alive then. But these stories have been told repeatedly. And so I almost sort of absorbed them like osmosis, and as if they were mine. And I thought, well, yeah, I think I want to write about that. Because what was difficult about it was actually not to put in some of the things he did. Nobody would have believed them. I mean, when I was very young, Mum and I slept in the parlour with him. He was actually dying over 2 years of cancer. And he just got up one day and went to chop her head off with this axe. I mean, my sister hit him over the head with a bottle. You can't put that in a film. I mean, you can't. And no one will believe it. Those days when you had cancer, the morphine, you were only allowed so much morphine. And when the morphine wore off, he was even more violent. And we had one of those little utility suites, which are like brown leatherette, piped in cream, I remember. And I turned out like this. He said, you move and I'll fucking kill you. And I didn't move for 4 hours. So it was that kind of atmosphere in which I grew up. But once he died, my mother and came alive, she started to live. We all started to live. And that house drew everybody to it. I mean, Friday nights were fabulous because all my sister's friends came and I was allowed to go for the makeup. I can smell Fridays, even now. And the most expensive scent you could buy was Evening in Paris. You know, oh, God, it was so romantic. Then we came alive. And that huge difference, it was a huge leap, you know, to see my mother, who was battered beyond belief, having her hair done for the first time. I remember thinking, God, doesn't she look so beautiful? Didn't she look so beautiful? And she never had it done. I mean, on one occasion, Monica came round to see our Arlene, and Arlene wasn't there. And my mother opened the door and she said, will you comb my hair? He won't allow me to comb my hair. What a bastard. I really was so horrible. And when I went into therapy for a while, because we all do, we really bonded. And by the time I'd finished, even he hated my father as well.
It's a great thing with you, Terence. You only have to ask one question and you get all these brilliant anecdotes and answers.
I don't get out a lot.
I mean, the film, as you've said, is biographical, but it's also, you used a great phrase. I remember when you've spoken about the film, and I think Beryl Bainbridge repeats it in an essay that she wrote for the film in The Guardian. It's a film about memory, but it's a film about the mosaic of memory, and you piece together memories, some of which may be yours, some of which may be remembered memories. And I think this film takes a really interesting approach to the subject of memory and the subject of biography, because not all the memories in the film are yours. Some of them are. Can you just talk about that, and that phrase particularly, the mosaic of memory, because I think it's such a lovely piece of phrasing.
Well, when I was, we got our first television around about 1960, I think, and when I was in my teens, one night, well, over four nights, Alec Guinness read the whole of the Four Quartets from memory. I mean, I was knocked out by it. I didn't understand a word, but I went out and bought them. In fact, I read them every month. They're just fabulous. But it's about the nature of time and memory. How do you show time? Passing forward or backward, how do you remember? Memory isn't linear. It's not this happened, this happened. It's not like that. It's cyclical. A pebble is dropped into the pool and all the ripples are memory. And you remember emotionally, not what happened next, but each moment that lived, as Eliot says, the intensity of the moment, no before, no after. And that's what memory is like. And I thought, well, if I follow my inner ear and watch with my inner eye, although I was very inexperienced, I felt that that was the only thing that I had. That was my anchor, if you like. But I was also brought up on the American musical, because my sisters loved American musicals, and so they took me. My first film at seven was Singing in the Rain. I mean, how can you not fall in love with music and cinema? And if you look at that sequence when he sings Singing in the Rain, it is from at nine cuts from eight positions. That's all. I mean, and it seems to go on forever, but that's all it is. You know, take an even more extreme example. Psycho, the scene in the shower, it lasts 42 seconds and took a week to shoot. That's what's so powerful about cinema. If you can get it right, you just literally need a trick. Like smell. You can't have smell in the cinema, but smell is very important. You know, I smell cut grass and I'm immediately back into my primary school. Like that, 60 years ago. And so it's the same with memory. But when the images move to music, and they're right, there is something so unutterably thrilling about it. I mean, The Big Country, for instance, the only score that Jerome Ross wrote, you watch that opening sequence. Oh, God, it's breathtaking. It's a fabulous, fabulous score. But you go back to The Robe and it's Alfred Newman writing lovely music, you know, for The Robe, which was the very first CinemaScope film that was made. And I remember seeing it and the curtains went back and the audience gasped, literally, because it was such a huge screen. But it has to be visceral. It has to be felt, then put into some sort of emotional order. Music is very like cinema, or cinema's like music. You don't have to be a musician to follow the emotional journey in a symphony. You don't. But you respond to the music viscerally. In the first 2 minutes, you either like it or you don't. And when you do go on that journey, you don't know where you're going to be led. In a way, music isn't narrative in that sense. Film is. But you can drop an idea in the first 2 minutes. And 40 minutes later, it comes to fruition, and we all remember it. And it's very, very satisfying. It's like hearing a cadence which finally comes, which you've waited for 20 minutes for in a symphony, and it comes, and you think, that's what I've waited for.
The music in this film, Jeff Andrew, who we're talking about at dinner, who's a writer, been a big supporter of your work, he used the phrase, he said, the music in this film flows like blood, and it does. But I also wanted to ask, you're obviously, with the way that you conjure memory, you're very good at texture in film. And by texture, I don't just mean visual, I mean audio texture. And the music is incredibly important for this, but also sound. You know, I remember growing up and listening to the shipping forecast, which obviously starts the film, and the football results being read out, which is a major part of Time in the City. And I have to say, I've never ever heard the football results read out when the team that I support win, which follows reality, unfortunately. But, you know, the sound of rain in this film. This is a film that, for a filmmaker that had made three shorts, the concentration on every single aesthetic, your attention to detail is incredible. Can you just say something about that, just in connection to sound, but in connection as well to the visuals, the colours, the dresses, the textures, the wallpaper? Even the wallpaper is alive in the films. Just how you respond to
But that comes from just watching films and not absorbing it, not knowing that you're absorbing it consciously. I mean, if you look at the interior for It Always Rains on Sunday, the wallpaper in the hall is suffocating. But, and you don't notice that consciously. You notice it emotionally. And I know what texture's like. For instance, you never saw primary colour in the street. Never. You only saw primary colour in schools with that gummed paper that you used to cut out things. If someone wore something that was of primary colour, it was very unusual. And one of my sisters, when she got engaged, bought a dress that had these little roses on them and a red bolero jacket. That was really unusual. It was really unusual. And a girl who lived opposite, called Pat Culph, it became fashionable in the very early 50s for women to wear costume suits and have a furled umbrella. And she had this blue costume suit with this light blue furled umbrella with a tassel on the end. God, I thought it looked so romantic. You know, you have to feel that. But also, look, going in into the street and looking at the cobbles after rain and thinking, I must remember what that looked like. I've no idea why. No idea why. Hourly, that's just what I remember. When I grew up, we had a radio, like everybody, one of those old Bakelite things. And the home, the light, and the third were the three BBC thing. And the home service started first. And it started with the weather forecast. And as soon as you hear that voice, it's the way in which it's spoken. Fair hour, Cromarty 40s, winds freshening south to southeast, moderate to poor visibility, with some fog banks. Isn't it erotic? I still don't know what it means. The scores, I mean, I can't bear any kind of sport. I just find it so boring. But the way in which they read those wonderful Hamilton academicals. Isn't that? I mean, why Sheffield Wednesday? Why not Sheffield Thursday afternoon? So that's very much part of it. And also, what is silent? I mean, our lives were very silent. You had the radio and talk. That was it. No one had television. It was too expensive. So I was conscious of silence. And when you're the youngest, no one really asks you what your opinion is. You know, you just listen. And I listened. And I'm still a good listener because of that. But it's finding those things which have so much meaning for you, and you hope that you can transmit that. I mean, when we were doing the scenes in the parlour, the art director who found this wallpaper, which had little red roses on it, and it was exactly like the wallpaper that was in our parlour. I mean, I remember going onto the set and thinking, God, I said, where on earth did you get it? Where? So it's never cut and dried. You're always, your antennae are always out. I mean, when I wrote the opening, I knew there was something wrong. And I thought, there's something wrong. It needs something. Anyway, I thought, I can't think. I'll switch. I always listen to Radio 3. And I switched on the concert, and the concert ended early, and they said there's a fill-up now between now and 1 o'clock news, and it was Jesse Norman singing There's a Man Going Round Taking Names. I thought, I've found it. You have to be out there. But I mean, when we shot it, the cast thought it was a country and western song. There's a man going round taking names. Well, no, it's not. You know, it's not Dolly Parton and Stand on Your Man or whatever it's called. So you have to be open to all these influences that you had and that you are about to have. It's just being alive to what it feels like. You have to watch with your inner eye. You have to listen with your inner ear. That's what you have to be true to.